Veterans coming home from Afghanistan and Iraq face a myriad of challenges. This hour, understanding and treating PTSD. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll ask researcher Suzanne Borgia of the National Institutes of Health about the latest research on post-traumatic stress syndrome. We'll also hear about treatment from a Des Moines psychologist. Later in the hour, I'll talk with an Iowa veteran drawing attention to PTSD and the epidemic of veteran suicide by running across Iowa. He'll run the whole distance across the state while wearing a military-style gas mask. That's all coming up. First, this hour's news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we know U.S. veterans coming home from tours in Afghanistan and Iraq can face major challenges readapting to civilian life. And among the biggest hurdles some veterans face is coping with post-traumatic stress disorder. PTSD can occur after you've been through a trauma, and incidentally, not just a trauma in the military. Of course, many of our first responders who've never been in the military can suffer from PTSD. A trauma, a shocking, dangerous event that you see or that happens to you triggers PTSD in some people. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs estimates that PTSD afflicts almost 31% of Vietnam veterans, as many as 10% of Gulf War veterans who fought in Iraq, and 11% of veterans of the war in Afghanistan. Symptoms include reliving those traumatic events in nightmares, also in flashbacks. To get a better idea of it, let's listen to Dexter Pitts, an Army veteran, back in 2011 on NPR's Talk of the Nation. He described some of the fear associated with his PTSD.
Yeah, afraid to drive, afraid to just go out and talk to people, afraid to talk to people you know in your whole life because you don't want people to look at you like, hey, you're different, then you've changed. You don't want to hear that because in your mind you're still thinking, I'm still the same person, but you're really not. When you go overseas and you get hurt or just going overseas and even surviving a tour, you leave a piece of yourself over there. You don't come back the same person. It's just not possible.
Pitts had been seriously injured by a bomb while driving a Humvee in Baghdad. He nearly lost his arm. He talks about his realization that his PTSD was a problem.
Soon after I got back, I remember I was laying in my room. My mom had adopted my little cousin. I believe he was 9 at the time. He kept coming to my room, and he kept bothering me, and I was like, Zach, leave me alone. Just leave me alone. And he wouldn't leave me alone. I yelled at him. Next you know, he got mad at me, came in the room, and he hit my injured arm. And at that point, I just lost. I blacked out. I chased him down the hallway, grabbed him by his shirt, picked him up, punched him in his chest as hard as I could. And my mom was like, what are you doing? And I was just had this blank stare on my face, and that's when my mother was like, baby, you need some help. And at that point, that's when I realized that, you know what, maybe I really do need some help.
Dexter Pitts, an Army veteran, speaking back in 2011. PTSD can also lead to thoughts of suicide. It's estimated that an average of 20 veterans a day die by suicide. This hour, we focus on PTSD among our veterans. Later in the hour, I'll talk with an Iowa veteran, a couple of them, and as a matter of fact, one Iowa veteran drawing attention to PTSD and the problem of veteran suicide by running across Iowa. And get this, he'll run the whole distance across the state by wearing a military-style gas mask the whole time he runs. But first, where are we in terms of better understanding PTSD, and are we making headway in treating this ailment? Joining us, Dr. Susan Borgia is with us, researcher at the National Institutes of Health. She specializes in post-traumatic stress syndrome research. Susan Borgia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ben. Good to be here.
So what important advances have we made in recent years understanding PTSD?
Well, I think there's a lot of research that's going on that's really trying to improve the situation for service members and veterans, particularly in the realm of treatment. And unfortunately, we don't have a lot of new treatments to offer them. We have treatments that work, but we don't have new things, and those treatments that work, they don't work for everyone. So one of the areas that we're really trying to do better at is to understand the variety of different ways that people have PTSD. Mm-hmm. Researchers are just now getting around to where many clinicians have complained about this for a long time, that every patient's different, and they come in often not just with PTSD, but with depression, with other anxiety disorders, TBI, and too often substance abuse.
And talk a little bit about the research that's been done to explain this. In fact, we have gene variants in all of us that explain why, you know, you may not experience PTSD after an event that you and I both went through, while I may have that.
Absolutely. There's research that's going on that suggests that PTSD has some genetic relationship. There is some heritability to this. Genes don't explain everything. They probably explain a small amount of what goes on in this environment, that you're faced with an unexpected horrific event and how you come to cope and deal with that. We know that females, so me actually, I'm more likely to have a heritable genetic relationship than you as a man. So there's a lot of research that's going on that says, you know, this isn't just in people's heads. There is a biology to it, but we're in the early days of understanding that biology.
Mm-hmm. And it's not a matter, and this is a myth, it's sort of being strong mentally. That's the wrong way to think about it, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think asking for help is one of the strongest things that a service member or veteran can do, mm-hmm. to say, this is a problem, and what I'm doing isn't working, and I need somebody to help me with that.
Tell us a little bit, Susan, about what brain scans can help in this area.
Well, we know a lot about the differences in people that experience trauma, and especially those that have PTSD, that we see actual structural changes to people's brains. So areas like the hippocampus that you use for memory, we know that memory is really important for post-traumatic stress disorder. We see structural differences there. We also see differences in how the brain works, so activity in areas like the amygdala that you use for emotion regulation. And people are taking this research on these brain differences and what we can look at in the brain. So there was a paper, or a series of papers actually, by Amit Etkin's lab in American Journal of Psychiatry last month that looked at these activity differences that suggest people who might benefit from treatment. So using an fMRI, they looked at blood flow in the brain while participants did tasks in a scanner before and after they went to therapy to see if they could understand what's going on in therapy and also predict who would best benefit from that. Mm-hmm. And they were able to see differences in those same regions that we see some of these important changes with PTSD. So areas like the amygdala, people who are more able to regulate that area were more likely to respond to treatment. This is really exciting work, because if we can better understand some of the circuits that change, we might be able to tailor our treatments to those specific circuits.
This is really interesting when we talk about brain imaging, Susan. We heard the veteran just moments ago talk about not being the same, realizing he's not the same person. So actually you can make the case. It's not just that you think you're a different person, but actually the brain chemistry, the physiology of the brain has been changed by trauma?
Absolutely. How the brain's working is different. The brain is a very adaptive organ that we don't know enough about, and it changes with all of our experiences. And something as profound as the experiences of combat certainly change how your brain is working. And in many cases, that's a good thing. We want our service members to be alert and to be able to pay attention to everything that's going around them and pay attention to those danger cues when they're there. The trouble is when they come home and those same triggers are being misinterpreted. So you hear a car backfire, and it's not gunfire, it's a car backfiring, and you misinterpret that as being a danger sign instead of just a car backfiring that most of us would ignore.
Mm-hmm. Does it also explain that some veterans of Iraq or Afghanistan, a certain part of them, and often they are drawn back into service, they miss something? Is that having to do with the fact that their brain was changed and adapted to that environment, that very threatening environment? They come back here, and then that brain that had been threatened and had adapted to that threat finds it difficult to function in a less threatening society.
It might. There's also an incredible social context to combat and being a member of a unit, and the valor that the soldiers have to feel that sense of duty and responsibility to their unit, to really want to go back and serve. Our all-volunteer forces give tremendously. The sacrifices that they make are amazing, and there's a lot of reasons why a service member may want to return to serve their country.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, what are the various avenues now for treatment of PTSD?
The treatments with the most research support are trauma-focused, meaning the treatment focuses on the memory of the traumatic event or its meaning. These include psychotherapies like prolonged exposure and cognitive processing therapy. They usually last for 8 to 16 sessions. There's also medications that have been shown to be helpful in treating PTSD symptoms. These are the same medications that people take for depression and anxiety. So there's two medications, sertraline and paroxetine, known by their trade names of Zoloft and Paxil, that are approved by the FDA. And all these treatments work for many, many people, but unfortunately, none of them work for all patients that present with PTSD.
Mm-hmm. There's something called also as well in treatment now called magnetic impulse therapy. What do you know about that?
I think you might be referring to transcranial magnetic stimulation.
Okay.
And that is a neurostimulation treatment that is being developed. So I don't know that I'd recommend it right now for anybody that's suffering from PTSD. But this is one of those avenues and a new tool that we're working on that can stimulate really specific areas and circuits within the brain. So findings like the one I talked about with the brain imaging, where they could see these differences in specific areas and regions, you might be able to adapt how those circuits are working and provide more specific treatment and better match treatment to what patient's specific condition is. So if a patient has a particular circuit that's not working quite how you'd want it to, we may in the future be able to really target that and help the patient most in the area that they're struggling with.
Mm-hmm. Still more research needed on that specific treatment, though.
Absolutely.
It sounds like. So isn't one of the biggest challenges, Susan, from what my reading tells me, is it's difficult to get to those with PTSD to realize they need treatment. I cited this suicide statistic, an estimated average of 20 veterans a day dying by suicide. Many of them not having received treatment, many of them not having wanted treatment.
Absolutely. I think that there's a lot of isolation that can happen, and there's a number of reasons for that. You're trained to be self-reliant, self-sufficient, and oftentimes that can work to your detriment. And these changes don't happen overnight. They're gradual, and you're often the last person to realize the struggles you may be having or the changes that have happened. And so family members and friends may first notice those differences in you, and they're an essential part of helping support and get our service members and veterans into the treatments that are best for them.
Do we know what percentage or how many veterans in some way who need treatment are not getting it for whatever reason?
It's too many.
It's too many.
Would be my answer.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of skepticism that treatment's not going to help them. And I don't think that that's the case for many people. Treatments do work, and they can help a number of people.
What can you tell us, finally, about the connection between PTSD and suicide? Why is suicide seen as an option to some of those who are suffering from this?
It seems like it may be the only option for people, unfortunately, and that's not the case. There is help available. I'd like to make a plug just for the Veterans Crisis Line. It's a toll-free number, 24/7, 365. They'll be answered and connect you with qualified responders that can deal with any impending crisis, 1-800-273-8255. There's a suicide epidemic in this country, and we realize that, and we're trying to do everything we can to prevent even one suicide from happening.
Okay, thank you very much. Susan Borgia, researcher at the National Institutes of Health, specializing in PTSD research, joining us from Maryland, I believe, today. Susan, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joined now by Suzanne Zilber, as we talk about PTSD, the struggle that many of our returning vets have with post-traumatic stress syndrome. Suzanne is a psychologist in private practice in Ames. Welcome to our program, Suzanne.
Thank you. Thank you. Pleasure.
Tell us, how does your work intersect with veterans and PTSD?
Well, my work is to do an initial assessment of veterans in terms of whether they have PTSD or other mental health disorders for the VA compensation system. And the good news about that is that veterans who would otherwise avoid having any sort of contact with a therapist or a counselor, they are motivated to come in because there may be some financial compensation for, and but they often will suffer, not be able to sleep the night before they come in. It's a really hard thing for them to do. Now, fortunately, once they get here, I put them at ease, and I'm really impressed by the sincerity and honesty that the veterans bring to the conversation we have about their situation.
In that conversation, Suzanne, what do you most want to find out about a new veteran walking through the door?
So I will find out first just about their life in general, how they're doing health-wise, what their educational and occupational experiences have been, what's happening in their families or their social relationships. Do they still enjoy any hobbies? And then whether they've had any treatment at all. And some of the veterans have had good treatment at the VA, but maybe just not enough of it. And then if it's an evaluation for PTSD, I'm instructed to just ask a little bit about that so they don't have to go too much in detail about those trauma stressors that would qualify them for that diagnosis, but just enough so I can verify that. And then we talk more about what are the symptoms that are affecting their day-to-day life.
And after they see you, depending on what you ascertain there, what is their next mm-hmm. step?
Well, oftentimes I do try to make a pitch for the veteran to get some sort of therapy or do some sort of self-help activity like using guided imagery or reading. And I'll sometimes help a veteran find a therapist in their area where they live because sometimes they come from far away.
Mm-hmm.
And for others, it's just that they may be going back to their provider they already have and continuing with trying to get better.
Are there common big challenges you face again and again in such cases?
Well, you know, certainly human beings are pretty motivated to avoid having negative emotion. And so, unfortunately, the process of psychotherapy, whether it's the methods that the researcher mentioned, the prolonged exposure and cognitive processing or EMDR or other trauma-focused methods will require to have some negative emotion briefly in a supportive context so that then that can be transformed at that neurological level. And so people who are used to trying to suppress all the negative emotions, that sort of worked for them for a while. And so it's a little scary for them to think that going towards that emotion is actually going to get them better. But it will get mm-hmm. them better.
I wonder, too, if you can leave us, Suzanne, with any tips for those family members, friends, loved ones interacting with someone who is showing symptoms of PTSD.
Well, I think that what the family members can emphasize is that the veteran is maybe suffering more than they deserve. And some of the veterans I'm really impressed with, they're so heroic. They recognize that they don't have the ability to control their anger. And so they want to protect everybody from their anger. So they just totally isolate themselves. And then they suffer in that loneliness and that isolation. And that's where suicidal thoughts can sort of really get a lot of traction. Mm-hmm. So it's really important for veterans to stay socially connected, but also for family members to understand how scary that is for the veteran. But to really encourage that the veteran create a healing, trusting relationship with somebody who's trained in trauma treatment, and then to, as the veteran begins to get better, to really notice that and say, hey, I'm noticing this improvement. So the veteran has evidence that, oh, this therapy is working, and so that they will continue. Because it's easy to sort of drop out of something that's uncomfortable, maybe a little too early before it's had a chance to have what I would call a clinical dose of treatment.
Yeah, and very quickly, I imagine a stigma still surrounds PTSD in society, especially in the military specifically, though. Suzanne, are we doing a better job? Is that improving that vets don't have a problem with the stigma, or many can put that aside?
Well, I do believe that the VA is doing a really nice job of trying to expand the access of veterans to these evaluations, and that the only sticking point is if the veteran wants to return to military service, then a PTSD diagnosis is not helpful to them. And so when you're in the service, it's really hard to get mental health treatment because you will then have career consequences for that.
Okay. Suzanne Zilber, psychologist in private practice in Ames. So you've just heard dealing with some veterans with PTSD. Thank you, Suzanne, from Ames.
Thank you so much.
River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's also talk with Fred Travis, director of the Center for Brain, Consciousness, and Cognition at Maharshi University School of Management in Fairfield. Hello, Fred.
Hi, Ben.
We have just a few minutes, but tell us, you studied African refugees with PTSD and found that meditation worked?
Yes, and to understand how, we have to understand that PTSD is a natural response to an unnatural situation. The natural response is the brain always tags specific experiences that it wants to remember. And so it tags threat, it tags meaningful, tags novel experiences. And what it does by tagging it, you're actually, the brain processes it more deeply. You get more of the aspects of that experience and memory. So this is good. It's a natural situation. But this is what's activated in an unnatural situation, which is trauma, which is war, in which all of the rules that you live life by are out the window. You're expected to kill another human being. You're expected to hate another. And your sense of self is being threatened. Mm-hmm. And what this does is it seems to permanently turn on this part of the brain. It's called the amygdala, which keeps you hyperactive. The amygdala, by analogy, is like a fire alarm. And it's really there so that when you're talking with your friend, and if a fire alarm went off right now, we would hang up and we would take care of what the danger was. That's what this response is. That's what the amygdala is for. It's to tell the person, okay, stop what you're doing, focus on the situation that needs your full attention. It's a positive response, but in this unnatural situation of war, it gets permanently stuck on. Mm-hmm. So the person with post-traumatic stress is as if always having the fire alarm going on full speed.
Okay.
Completely loud in their ears.
Fred, so in the two or so minutes we have remaining, tell us how meditation, TM specifically in the case of the Maharshi School of University School of Management, how that meditation can counter that fire alarm going off constantly.
How it works is an experience has turned on the alarm, and the experience was the exact opposite can turn it off. And that's what the meditation experience is, especially an experience that leads to transcending. It leads to an experience of yourself which is whole, which is awake, which is safe, which is vital. And what this does is the brain responds to it, and so the fire alarm is turned off. This is what we saw in this research with African refugees. In just 10 days of transcendental meditation practice, there was clinically significant reductions in post-traumatic stress symptoms. After 30 days, they were at non-symptomatic.
Mm-hmm. And I understand some neuroimaging involved in this research as well?
This is all behavioral research. Right.
Okay.
Now we're planning the neuroimaging to support what we see behaviorally. This is also seen in random assignment studies of Vietnam vets. It's being seen now in a study in San Diego, funded by Department of Defense, comparing transcendental meditation, transcending, to prolonged exposure, which is the exact opposite,
okay,
flooding the senses.
Fred, thank you for sharing the research. That's all the time we have right now. Thank you, Fred Travis, director of the Center for Brain, Consciousness, and Cognition at Maharshi University School of Management in Fairfield. When we come back, we continue to talk about the problem of PTSD among veterans. We'll talk with an Iowan veteran drawing attention to PTSD by running across Iowa with a military-style gas mask. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
We're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, talking this hour about post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, and other challenges facing veterans coming home from Afghanistan and Iraq. As I mentioned at the outset, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs estimates that PTSD afflicts almost 31% of Vietnam veterans, as many as 10% of Gulf War veterans, those who fought in Iraq, and 11% of veterans of the war in Afghanistan. This half hour, we'd like to welcome a couple of veterans to our conversation. Joining us, first of all, is Joshua Jorgensen, an Army veteran of the Gulf War from Adel, and he is running across Iowa in the fall. He'll run the whole distance, get this, across the state while wearing a military-style gas mask. Joshua Jorgensen joins us now from Adel. Hi, Joshua.
Hi, how you doing, Ben?
I'm doing great. So before we get a little bit more into your background, I want to say thank you so much for your service to our country.
Yeah, no problem.
And tell us, why are you, tell us about the run that you're planning.
Well, I guess first of all, whenever I hear it repeated back to me, it sounds crazier and crazier. But it was an idea that I have had for a while and thought if I do it in the gas mask, then it might actually help raise awareness for PTSD for veterans and other people who do suffer from PTSD and also, families of veteran suicide and awareness for that.
Mm-hmm. So what is it like to run a longer distance or run at all with a military gas mask on?
It's a good level of suffering. It's constrictive as far as breathing, constrictive as far as vision. So it's really like running with tunnel vision, and you have to be very aware of your breathing.
Mm-hmm. Does it steam up?
It does once in a while, yeah. In the hotter weather, kind of like just wearing a pair of sunglasses or something, it can fog over from time to time. But breathing in, and it keeps the air moving a little bit, so it doesn't do it as bad as you might think.
Mm-hmm. And you plan to keep this on from river to river, if I can use that phrase, from one side of Iowa to the other?
Well, not quite that extreme, but anytime I am moving from the Missouri River to the Mississippi River, it will be on. Any forward movement, it will be on. There will have to be times where I'll have to stop and so I can eat food and refuel and everything, and then we're also going to kind of minimize the amount of running that's done at night just for safety reasons.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you say you're looking forward to this?
I'm absolutely looking forward to this. We announced this probably back in last November. And so it's been one of the number one things on my mind this entire year. And yeah, I would have gone and done it a month ago if my wife would let me.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about Joshua, if you could. What can you share with us about your time in the military? You joined at an early age. You're a Gulf War veteran.
No, not a Gulf War veteran, Daniel is. I'm actually a veteran of Operation Iraqi Freedom.
Mm.
So in 2003, 2004 is when I was over there. So I was in from 2000 to 2004 as far as an active duty in the 101st Airborne Division. And I really enjoyed the military. It was it's a brotherhood unlike anything I've ever experienced before. It was a lot of fun, going over to a combat zone. I wouldn't necessarily consider that to be a fun part, but it was necessary, and I enjoyed being able to be a part of that, and being able to, fight for my country. So,
mm-hmm. Tell us, do you struggle at all with PTSD?
Yeah, absolutely. Every day is kind of I wake up and I, go into the civilian world and go to my job and. And every day I'm reminded of, things I've done in my past, things I've done in the military, things I enjoyed, some things I didn't enjoy. And it's a life that I miss being a part of from time to time, which I think prompts me to go and do these running events and these running adventures that still revert back to my military training and things I liked doing when I was there.
And so they have to do with your participation in the Iraq War, that invasion from Kuwait into Iraq. You were part of that.
Yeah, I was. We were there a few weeks before the war actually started, and so we crossed the border when the war officially was underway, and I was there for a year.
Mm-hmm. It's been a long time, and I understand these are intense experiences that you have, but do they fade at all? You say they're present with you every day. Do they fade, take on a different quality over time that you can kind of put them, I guess, in a box?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the longer you live with something, the longer you deal with it, you start to kind of weed out the stuff that, you know, wasn't as big of an effect on you as other things were. You know, I got into this ultra distance running right as I got out of active duty for the reason of being able to occupy my mind with something else, or being able to get out of the house, go do something constructive while I am thinking about that stuff, and really being able to process all of it and kind of weed out that stuff or you know, find a balance with it all.
Mm-hmm. So, and when you have these ultra sports or extreme sports, how did you've worked with the wearing the gas mask at some of these, as you will during this run across Iowa? How did that enter the picture? Was that your idea? Did you see that somewhere?
I've seen it. I've seen other veterans do that to raise awareness at a few different events, and it was one of those things that, even as an Army soldier, that was difficult. Of all the things that we did, that was one of the things that it would bring really strong men to their knees trying to operate that way. And so I got to a point where I was running with a rucksack with weight in the back. I was running with my ballistic bulletproof vest with the weighted plates in it. I was running in boots. I was doing all that stuff, and I continued to challenge myself with other ideas. And so when I had seen this in a couple different spots, I said, well, I think I could do that. I really want to try to do that. And so that's kind of how it came to be, and it progressed from, I did a stair climb in downtown Des Moines with it. It progressed to one marathon, then it progressed to six marathons, then it progressed to a bunch of different running events, to the point where when I decided I was going to run across the state, I said, you know what, I think instead of being one of the handful of guys that have run across the state, I think I could do it with a gas mask on.
Interesting. If you just joined us, Joshua Jorgensen is with us, an Army veteran of the Iraq War. He's from Adel. And just to mention also an email from Gregory listening to this program. Gregory writes, I appreciate that you are presenting this story on PTSD. I am a former Army JAG officer and have represented many clients with PTSD. So it is a complicated problem that we all need to address. Joshua, your sense that, are we getting better at this and tackling the epidemic? We mentioned an average of 20 veterans a day dying by suicide. I wonder, say that you've had experienced PTSD. Can you explain to those of us who haven't experienced this sort of trauma, how do you get to suicidal thoughts? So why does that seem like an option in certain circumstances?
Oh, I'm sure there's multiple answers to that. You know, I think people find themselves standing at either a crossroads or even possibly a dead end, that they're not sure where they can turn. I think it, in my opinion anyway, it reverts back to something my dad told me, who's a Vietnam vet. He told me the night I told him that I signed up to go into the Army, he said, I wish I could sit down and tell you all of my experiences, but you won't understand any of them until you go through them yourself. And you've got to understand that nobody's ever going to understand what you went through if they haven't gone through it either. Mm. And so So in my opinion, and why I really was pushed to want to do something like this and raise the awareness, is because I was in the military, I was a leader in the military, and I take it very personally when people, you know, when I find stories of guys killing themselves or guys falling into deep depressions because they have nowhere else to turn. I take that very personally as a leader, even if I didn't lead them personally or know them personally. I take it personally because as a leader, my time leading soldiers isn't complete. I mean, now that we're out and we're in the civilian world, I think we need to have more leaders that can step up and say, hey, I've got another way to go. I've got another path. You know, I want to take you down this path, and I want to lead you to recovery instead of giving you the option to, you know, the ultimate of killing yourself with no feeling you have no other option.
Joshua Jorgensen with us, Army veteran of the Iraq War, involved in the very thick of it, from that invasion mounted from Kuwait into Iraq, involved in the infantry. He's a team leader as well, infantry assault, reconnaissance, ground fighting. Joshua took a part in. You mentioned Daniel a little earlier in our conversation. We want to get him into this conversation. Joshua, do that by telling us your connection with Team Fidelis. Daniel Brazel is the executive director for Team Fidelis.
Yeah, I actually met Daniel. I was in the middle of running a marathon down in Kansas City with the gas mask on, with my ballistic vest on and my boots. And I came running up about mile 10, and this is back in April of 2016. And I come running up about mile 10 where this Team Fidelis had an aid station set up, or they were helping with the aid station there. And I felt this pat on my back, and a guy come up behind me that I've never seen before and hands me some patches that say Team Fidelis on, and he goes, I want you to put one of these on your vest. We kind of made contact then on social media after that, and from there I've been down to his house, met his family a few times, had a great time with him every time, and participated in some Team Fidelis events, and I really love what they're doing.
Okay, so let's welcome the executive director for Team Fidelis, also a Marine Corps veteran, Daniel Brazel. Welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. You've been on board listening here the last few minutes. Thank you for your service to our country. I understand you've spent 10 years in the Marines?
Yes, I was a combat engineer in the Marine Corps for 10 years before I was medically discharged for PTS.
Okay, so tell us, because that's the focus of our show, about your experience with that. When did you realize... we hope you've gotten help, but when did you realize you needed help? What happened that just didn't work anymore?
Well, honestly, I didn't realize I had it. So I was just having some struggles. I just kind of was getting depressed, and they sent me to the doc, and the doc was like, you do this, this, and this. And I'm like, well, of course I do those things. I'm a Marine. Like, we excel. And they're like, that's not normal what you're doing.
For instance, so can you give us an example of what you said that you thought was normal, that the doctor said this is not normal?
So just checking the perimeter at my house, making sure everything was good to go, everything was squared away, you know, just being very suspicious of folks and just kind of filling everybody out and then excelling, you know, working so hard. I was filling roles that were 3 and 4 levels above me that I probably shouldn't have been doing. But I was using my PTS, part of that anxiety, part of that extra adrenaline dump, I was using work to overwork to actually alleviate the stress from myself.
Okay. So tell us, what is Team Fidelis? How and why was it founded?
So Team Fidelis is a veteran organization that works to end the epidemic of veteran suicide. And we do that using our 3 pillars of awareness, hope, and camaraderie. And it really was founded because when I got discharged from the military, I didn't really understand what was going on with me. My wife and I, we came back to Kansas City area, and, you know, I had all my battle buddies that were on, you know, were at my unit with me, had all that support system, and all of a sudden I got out into the community, and now I'm alone. And we struggled, and I went through a lot of suicidal ideation, ended up in the hospital multiple times, trying to deal with, you know, obviously being a civilian now, not having that support and my battle buddies around me, and just trying to figure it all out. and it struggled. And once I kind of, through many years, luckily my wife stayed with me, I got on the other side of that. I looked back and said, I never want another veteran to go through that.
Mm-hmm. And so how much awareness are you raising? How big is the reach of Team Fidelis?
Well, we're about 400 members in the Kansas City area. We have team members in 30 states, different states, and we attend events. We probably reach, on average in a year, probably 100,000 people where we actually have their attention and we talk to them about our mission.
Mm-hmm.
and get connected with them. And it's not just veterans, it's their family members as well, because as the woman spoke earlier, she said, you know, it's the family members and the friends who are going to see those changes before anyone else does.
Mm-hmm. What tells you that you're making an impact on this epidemic of, well, suicide, average 20 per day of military veterans dying by suicide? What tells you you're having an impact with your work?
Really, the veterans themselves that are still here, that are still with us, the veterans that we get referred to us through maybe the Veterans Crisis Line when they call there. We have a great partnership with the suicide prevention coordinators at the VA here locally, and we'll get referrals from those. And those veterans that, you know, I pick up the phone at 3 o'clock in the morning who are crying to me and ready to take their lives. And, you know, here we are months later, and they're still around.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
So you have a veteran call you up. He wants to take his life. Step me through quickly. What is the timeline? What do you do in that case?
Well, all of our veterans, we have veteran specialists that we train. They're all trained in mental health first aid. So they actually have a action plan. So if someone calls and there's protocols in place, depending on what that person says to us and what's going on. Obviously, if they tell me that they have it, they're going to kill themselves. They have it specific, and they have a plan, and they have a timetable. Then it's an immediate call to 911, and we let them know. We call what is called a community intervention team police officer, who will go out there, who's specially trained to talk to those veterans who are having mental health crises, and we get them in front of with that police officer so we get them safe, because that's the number one thing. That we have to do is make sure that their safety at that time until they can come back from where they're at, and then we can start working with them in other ways.
Mm-hmm. It can be that veterans who are struggling are listening to both you and Josh at this moment. Can you give us some contacts, give us a direction that they can start and pursue a better life?
Absolutely. Well, if they're in crisis, the Veterans Crisis Line is 1-800-273-8255 and press 1 if they're a veteran, and they'll get contacted with someone who's specifically trained to deal with veterans in crisis. There's teamfidelis.org that they can go to the website. We have a Facebook page also, and then the VA. And I know a lot of individuals bag on the VA, but there's a lot to offer at the VA, and I really encourage my veterans, especially ones that are struggling. Sometimes they say to me, I go to my doctor, but it's not working. And I'm like, then you have to have that conversation with your doctor and say, hey, this, if it's prolonged exposure therapy, this is too much for me. Can I get something else? And they have cognitive-based therapies. They have all kinds of different things that they can do, and there's all kinds of different medications that are available. If they need to switch it up, they need to have that conversation and be strong enough to have that conversation. Say, this isn't working, but help me with something else, and mm-hmm. maybe we can get that help that they need.
Talk about the friends, family members, loved ones of those with PTSD, yours, Daniel, and yours, Joshua. What are some approaches that work best? And perhaps then you can also say, what are approaches that do not work, don'ts in these cases? Daniel?
I laugh because... You know, this was one of the things my wife actually went to an appointment with me, and she says, well, when he gets upset and everything like that, I just start asking him, what's going on? And she kind of, like, berates me, and the doc's like, don't do that. If he wants to go for a walk, let him go for a walk, because he's releasing some of that adrenaline that's dropped into the system. And if by you just continuing to do that, you're exacerbating the system, the situation, because it's just building up in him.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to really be cognizant of that and, you know, find out what it is for the veteran that eases him at that time. Maybe it's petting a dog. Maybe it's going for a walk, going for a run. you know, maybe he needs to go have a donut, whatever it might be, to let that, that give that veteran that release is what needs to happen.
Okay, Joshua, do you want to chime in there with a personal experience on that?
Yeah. I mean, it's just kind of like what he said. I mean, the support system from your family, I mean, first and foremost, you know, especially with a wife, you know, she's your wife for a reason. and you know, it's nothing personal against that individual that maybe today I just am kind of closed off from everything and everybody. And you know, I get tremendous support at home from my wife, and she knows, she can tell when I'm having a rough day or something, and she'll kick me out the door with my running shoes on.
Right.
Go, and when you get back, I'll see you when you get back.
Because all right.
That's what I need.
Okay. We've run out of time, unfortunately. Thank you so much, Joshua Jorgensen, for talking with us, and Daniel Bruzel, Executive Director of Team Fidelis. Sounds like you gentlemen are doing wonderful work for all the veterans suffering from PTSD, raising awareness for the rest of us. And we appreciate your service, of course, and all the things you're doing here now that you're stateside.
Yeah, thank you, Ben.
Thank you, sir.
River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Lindsay Moon, and Emily Woodbury, with help today from Helena Thompson. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.